WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
That was Little White Lies from that same session with Red Norvo, Tal Farlow, and Charles Mingus. Those sessions have recently been reissued by Savoy. Well, on the telephone with me now is Nat Hentoff to talk about some of his remembrances of the late Charles Mingus, who he has known for many years, I think about 25. Nat Hentoff has written extensively about jazz in periodicals, as well as the numerous books that he's written, and he also has a regular column in the Village Voice. He's also produced a Mingus Jazz Workshop album in the early 1960s, and later wrote liner notes for several of Mingus's records. Charles Mingus mentions their first meeting in his autobiographical work, Beneath the Underdog. This meeting, as he describes it, happened shortly after Ellington asked for Mingus's resignation from the band. And I'd like to read you that paragraph from his book, Beneath the Underdog. This, again, is right after Ellington asked him to resign. He writes, "Well, what do you do after that? You start with the gigs again. Maybe you go to Boston and play a titty at Storyville. And in Boston, you meet a very sensitive cat named Nat Hentoff, who interviews you on his radio show and turned out to be one of the few white guys you could really talk to in your life. Afterwards, you get in the habit of writing to him from time to time when you're feeling the pain in the middle of the night, and the larger questions that seem to have no answers loom up before your eyes. But Hentoff always digs the meaning of the question and replies, all in caps, on yellow paper like a story off the wires." And then Mingus goes on to reprint one of the letters that Nat Hentoff wrote him, a letter in which Nat Hentoff writes about the meanings of such things as hate, love, and life. Well, on the telephone with me now is Nat Hentoff. I'm very glad you could join us this afternoon.
Well, I'm glad you asked.
Could you recall for us that first time when you met Charles Mingus on your radio show?
Well, I wasn't in the show. He played Storyville.
Ah.
I think it was with Billy Taylor, or maybe with Red Norville. But anyway, I'd heard of Mingus on records, and musicians had told me about this guy who was turning the bass around, but the man had such presence that there was no way of anticipating the force of his playing. And then we got to talking, and the thing that struck me then and never ceased to impress me through the rest of his life was that there was nothing, practically nothing, he was not capable of and interested in exploring. Politics or the whole economic structure of the music business, a subject in which he had some very vehement ideas. But it was fascinating to talk to him. One of the reasons, well, two reasons. One, he had such a very clear, quick mind. And the other was that of all the people I've ever known, I've known a lot of different kinds because I'm a reporter, essentially, and I cover a lot of different kinds of beats. He was the most utterly honest in terms of saying what he felt as he felt it. I think he was incapable, even if he'd wanted to try, to dissemble. And so you really got, straight out what was going on in his head. And some people found that somewhat abrasive. I found it continually stimulating.
So you really started corresponding through the mail, huh? You and Mingus writing letters back and forth?
Yeah, the thing he mentions, the caps, was it happened. I didn't have a typewriter then. The only typewriter was in the radio station where I worked, and that happened to have all capital letters. I don't know why. But we corresponded for a long time. And then I came to New York to stay in 1953, and we saw quite a bit of each other through the 50s and 60s, and less so in recent years. He, as I think most people know, he had a period in the mid-60s when he was depressed. I don't mean depressed like having the blues. I mean what could be called clinical depression. I mean, it's a biochemical thing. And I know something about that scene, and I'd see him once in a while, but when you're in that, you really don't want to see anybody because you feel so low, you figure you're just not worth anybody talking to. And he got pulled out of that. It sounds like a movie, but it's true. He lived in a very beat-up section on the Lower East Side, and nobody in that block knew who he was or, what he played or anything, but he used to hang out once in a while in a bar, and he just got to know the people on the block, and they were very solicitous of him because they figured he was pretty down, and he, in turn, was of use to them when they had hassles, and he got to feel that, oh, gee, you know, these people think I'm okay, and that helped pull him out of it.
Well, in Beneath the Underdog, he describes the time he was really depressed and decided, you know, if you have a toothache, you go to a dentist. If you're depressed, you go to a hospital. So he tried to commit himself to Bellevue, and after trying to convince the guard for about 6 hours, the guard let him in. And once he got in, he realized he'd made a big mistake and wanted to get out. And the first person he called to get some help in getting out was you. Can you recall that for us?
Oh, I remember that very well. The call came in early one morning, and he said, they won't let me out of here. I went in voluntarily. And so I said, okay, hold on. And I, at the time, he's now dead, there was a marvelous civil liberties lawyer named Marvin Karpatkin, who not only knew the law, but had the tone of voice when he wanted to and the bearing of a commander-in-chief somewhere. And he called up the hospital, and he got him out, I think, within an hour or two. But, it italicizes that if a lot of people get hung up that way, and months go by before they get released.
When he refers to you in that little passage that I read in Beneath the Underdog, he says that you were one of the first white people who he felt he could really communicate with. Did you ever talk with him about being black in the music industry and some of his feelings about race in music?
Well, it would have been awfully hard to talk to Mingus without those subjects coming up, because there were things he thought about a long time. All the time, practically. He felt quite accurately, and it hasn't changed really now by contrast with then, that in his field, in jazz, or he preferred not to call it jazz, he preferred to call what he did Mingus music, which is what it was. But anyway, the people who produced it and sold it and all that, the people who ran the record companies, who owned the radio stations, to a large extent staffed the radio stations, the distributors, they're all white, and the booking agents as well. And that there was a sort of a systematic exploitation of the musician going on. And he obviously, in terms of the society at large, he was, to say the least, acutely sensitive, not only to individual racism, which he got from time to time from, you know, people in nightclubs, but also to individual racism, but also to institutional racism. The fact that the Vietnam War was a war in which mostly poor people, especially black kids, get sent over to fight, while the white middle class, including those who like Charles Mingus records, were deferred in college. I mean, those patterns he had no difficulty at all in seeing.
How did you react to him as a critic, when you first started becoming really familiar with his music? Did you go out of your way at all to write about his music? Do you recall some of the things that you wrote then?
As a writer on music, I don't really consider myself a critic. A critic is somebody who really knows the inside of it technically, which I don't, and who has aesthetic philosophies and all that stuff. And we've had very few in jazz. Andre Odair in France has been one of them. Martin Williams is another in this country. My interest has always been in writing about the music through the musician. I mean, if anything I've done is going to be of any use, it's been those articles and books which try to explain the life out of which the music comes. But in any case, I have done a lot of reviewing of recordings, and that sometimes does lead to difficulties if you're friendly with a musician. There have been times when people with whom I've been friendly got very, very annoyed for long periods of time because of something I'd written, and that's you just have to take that loss if you want to be straight. With Mingus, I never had that problem because Mingus, like Duke, and like Billie Holiday, I just never heard anything him do. I never heard him do anything that I didn't find a lot of absorbing interest in.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about what you think now of Mingus's work as a composer and as a leader? Could you put into words for us why you think he's a very important figure in jazz?
Well, we were talking last March, one of the last conversations we had, because after a while it was difficult for him to talk. And he said on at that time, although he was not playing the bass anymore, he was saying, even if he had been, he decided that what he most liked to do was composition, because that way he was in control of all the elements, at least at the start, and he had the chance, the time, to discard what he didn't want and to include what he did and then later revise it. And insofar as you can ever speculate as to how someone is going to most be remembered, actually, I think with Mingus, it's going to be a gestalt. I don't think it'll be possible to think of Mingus through the years without thinking of him both as a bass player, it's a triple thing, as a bass player who got, not only in terms of technique, but in terms of the range of sounds and the permutations of rhythms and the soul, to use that corny word, but that's the only thing that comes to mind that came out of that instrument. And as a leader, there was never a leader, ever, like Mike Mingus, in that nobody in the history of jazz that I know of, except maybe Jelly Roll, but I wasn't around then, but nobody within the last 35 years has ever demanded as much of his players as he did. I mean, Duke was superb, obviously, for what he wanted to do, and he wrote for the strengths of his players. He was not a disciplinarian. Mingus, however, did not protect his players. If anybody was coasting or playing familiar licks or whatever, or playing somebody else's licks, Mingus would let him know right out, you know, even in the middle of the set at some club, that he'd better stop that jive and try to get into what he was on his instrument. And as a result, I think I know most of the people who have been through, who are alumni of the various Mingus workshops, and although they have maybe mixed memories because there's a lot of tension sometimes, everyone I've talked to has said that the one thing that they learned from Mingus was who they themselves were. One of them said, my God, he had more confidence in us than we did. Then, of course, as a composer, I mean, I'm not going to go into technical discussions of structure and form, but the thing is that his music had such, I mean, it ranged emotionally through all kinds of feelings, and some of it narrative, some of it programmatic, some of it so-called pure music. But the one, and the thing that he took most pride in, and he mentioned this in that March conversation, he never repeated himself. He said there was no fun in it at all. If you just stylize yourself and you do maybe Pork Pie Hat in five different ways, you do Fables of Fathers six or seven different ways. So that's why he said, I never pay much attention to critics because they don't know what I'm going to do next. They're talking about something they've already done. But the essence of his music is, first of all, of enormously deep and compelling lyricism. Even in the angry pieces, like parts of Haitian Fight Song or Fables of Fathers, there wasn't that vehement, you know, that utterly abrasive kind of sound. He could not feel even anger without also feeling a kind of lyrical undercurrent, a sort of, if you were religious, which I'm not, would be called sort of a redemptive feeling. And then there was the drama of it. I don't mean drama like, you know, Hamming, but his melodic lines and the way that the rhythms worked into those structures, and they were never straight rhythms. They were always, I mean, his pieces always breathed. They breathed naturally. The combination, he really compelled attention. And then when you listen to them again and again, you begin to find out what else there is in there and all the intricate interplay. It's hard. I say this after a lot of years of trying to do it. It's hard to put music into words, and I think it's better to play it than to talk about it.
We'll, we'll be hearing some of Mingus's music soon. He also did some piano playing, and you mentioned on one of the liner notes that you wrote for one of Mingus's records that sometimes you'd pick up your telephone and what you'd hear would just be someone playing piano on the other end of the phone, and you'd know it was Mingus when that happened.
Yeah, sometimes the piano, sometimes I get a blast of music, and it would be either something that he just recorded and was going through the editing process, or something of somebody else's that he heard, and the music would go on for as long as he wanted it to go on, and then he'd get on and say, well, what do you think?
Could you hear anything on the phone like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's tinny, but you get a sense of what it is.
The other part of Mingus is like the legendary stories about his personality, his very volatile temper, his ways of showing his anger with some of the people in his band, stories about him knocking out the teeth of one of his band members.
Yeah.
Do you think that's been exaggerated over the years? Do you think that the stories of Mingus's temperament are pretty accurate representations of the way he was as a leader?
Well, the thing was when he was doing that kind of thing, which lasted not very long, and certainly was not in evidence, so far as I know, in the last 15 years or so. The sense I get of reading about it is that he was like that all the time, which is not true at all. He was very protean, very changeable. And if he was angry on a given night, he would not be angry at the end of the night. And he'd often be, not that it did the person he hit, which didn't happen too often, he was often very contrite. To my knowledge, there were two incidents on stand. One, he did indeed hit Jimmy Nippert, the trombone player, and then Jackie McLean claims that he whacked him too, but I don't know of any other incidents beside that. I also saw him once at a place we were at in the Berkshires called Music Inn, and there was some awful cat there from the South, a white Southerner, who was really going after Mingus with sort of Billy Carter kind of remarks. And Mingus did all he... I watched him that night. He did all he could to stop from hitting this cat. And finally, the guy almost had him literally cornered somewhere, and then Mingus dropped him in one shot. And he said afterward, he was shaking, he said, you know, the only reason I hit him was because I figured he was going to hit me. He was not violent in the sense that, you know, that dumb macho hooligan kind of thing, that bar fighting sort of stuff. When he usually hit it was for some kind of what he considered to be a preemptive reason that somebody was going to hit him first. I don't think he can justify that with Jimmy Nepper or whatever, and I don't think he can, you know, I don't know what the explanation of that was.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not. I mean, his essential nature was extreme. I mean, it's going to sound paradoxical, but his essential nature was very gentle, very open.
One of the lengthiest written pieces that we have about Mingus now is his own autobiographical work, Beneath the Underdog. And if you read that, you get a very strong sense of Mingus as someone who had a lot of women, who spent a lot of time dealing with sex. And it's amazing when you read it, there's so much more about his sexual life than there is about his music. How accurate a representation of the period of years that he writes about do you think this book is? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, he once showed me the original manuscript, which was at least five times longer than what finally came out. And the woman he worked with, Nell King, whom I knew slightly, I don't know to what extent she had a large or small hand in deciding what went in or what went out. It was more about music in the original. As to how accurate it was, for one thing, I forget if it's mentioned at all in the book, but there's a lot of time compressing going on in there, it's almost novelistic in some of its combinations of events and sliding through flashbacks, I guess you'd call it. How accurate was it? I don't know. I mean, he said it was, I believe.
Mm-hmm. You produced one of Mingus's records in the early 1960s for the Candid record label.
Yeah.
It was a session with Ted Kersen and Eric Dolphy,
mm-hmm.
Danny Richmond. Could you recall for us what that session was like? We're going to, in a couple of minutes, be hearing What Love from that session, which features in the middle a pretty extended duet with Mingus and Dolphy. Could you recall the general ambience of that session?
Yeah, well, all the dates I put quotes around produced for Candid, I did the same way. That is, the decision point for me was who was going to be in charge, and once that was decided, the musician in charge did everything else. I mean, he decided on his sidemen and who was going to do the writing and all that. And all I did really was keep the time and make sure that there was Coke and beer for those that wanted it. On that particular day, this was a band, after all, that had been playing together. And you don't often get this in a recording studio, you know, unless it's a modern jazz quartet when it was going. Been playing together for nearly a year in a place in the village. So they knew very well what they were all about. There was an additional, however, dimension of drama there because Eric Dolphy was about to leave, as was Ted Kersen. I don't think he regretted Ted's going, which is no put-down of Ted, but he really felt deeply about Dolphy, and that tension, of course, is, I guess it's in the piece that you're going to play, What Love. Anyway, Mingus came into the studio, and we used a small studio, Tommy Nola's studio, in Midtown, New York, and it was small, and that was good for small jazz, obviously, and it was a very relaxed scene. And an engineer, and this is, I find, very important, who not only likes music, but knows it, and so can adjust as he goes along. And Mingus said right off, he said, you know, even though we've been together a long time, we get into the studio, and there's always a kind of a feeling in a studio that's constricting to improvising, so why don't you turn down the lights? And I will make some short introductions, you know, as if this were a nightclub, a live nightclub thing. And that's what he did. And I've been in a studio a fairly large number of times, but I've never experienced anything like the music coming right at you. I mean, they never played together as well. Stanny Richmond, the drummer, said that night, and Charles himself, who was always very hard at his own recordings, also thought so. It was just I'm just damn glad we got it down.
There's some pretty avant-garde sounding work on this record. We'll hear some instances of really far out stuff on What Love that we're going to hear. Sometimes things that sounded really avant-garde when they were recorded sound more understandable as time goes on, because things that were avant-garde through the years sometimes become a part of the regular music vocabulary. How has some of the sounds on this record changed, if at all, to your ears over the past 15 or however years?
I wouldn't be the person to ask, because I knew the band so well, and I knew these sounds, at least in more or less different forms or similar forms, that they were entirely accessible to me then. But what you said, I think, it's worth adding a footnote. One of the things that annoyed Mingus through the years, more sometimes than at others, was when he would hear the critical stampede about the new great avant-gardist, and Mingus would be listening to the guy's record or hearing him in a club and said, I did that in 1945. And he did. I mean, we would tell you the record. You'd go back and hear the record. In many ways, he anticipated Coleman, and he anticipated much of what's going on now in terms of the AACM people. And while he got a fair amount of credit for being Mingus, which is the least you can get, the least you ought to expect. I still think, and it's probably going to take somebody to write a long annotated piece to point out how vital an innovative force he was, and how influential he was throughout jazz. And that started, as he said, in the 40s.
One last question, Nat Hentoff. Do you think that at this point in 1978, or in 79 now, do you think Mingus has received the amount of recognition from jazz listeners and jazz writers that he deserves?
Well, let me answer the question in two ways, in two parts. It's hard to categorize jazz listeners. There are some people who think that George Benson, who, let us admit, is a fluent guitar player, but really doesn't have very much to say when he's making the commercial records, but a lot of people buy his records, a lot more people buy his records than buy Cecil Taylor's records, and yet there's no comparison between the two in terms of quality and depth. I suppose that Mingus probably got about the same proportion, roughly the same proportionate amount of recognition from the jazz community, such as it exists, as somebody of his stature might have expected, which means to me that it wasn't nearly enough. But, I mean, obviously Mingus was known and he was respected. But the other part of that, and this is true of anybody of quality in jazz, and particularly of, well, black players being the ones who were always the key innovators, it's particularly true of them. In terms of the cultural scene at large, an epiphany as to the way Mingus was regarded was an obituary about him in the Daily News, in which the writer said, as if he were praising him, that, my goodness, this fellow was so impressive that he even got the respect of people involved in serious music, meaning classical music, as if classical music were the only serious music there was. And Mingus got very few grants, and unlike, classical players, or to me, my favorite scam is the Metropolitan Opera Company, which is housing a dead form, getting millions and millions of dollars of public money, while people, who are just barely surviving musically, but who are very much alive, are hardly getting any attention at all. So in that respect, his life, the end of his life, was like the beginning, in that he had indeed created a very large and lasting place for himself in the microcosm that is jazz, but in the society at large. Even because, let's say, commercial television wouldn't have had a Mingus program on under any circumstances. There was a short period when a guy named Bob Herridge was at CBS when that was possible. That's long gone. But, I mean, you look at so-called public television. They occasionally put on some glancing attempt at jazz. But where was the memorial for Mingus on public television? If Arthur Rubinstein had died, if even Leonard Bernstein had died, we'd have had a whole congeries of white people in the yard saying what a great loss this was. Mingus dies, and we you know, upstairs, downstairs returns, or something like that.
Right. Well, Ned Hantoff, when will you be writing about Charles Mingus? Can we look forward
Rolling
to...
Well, Rolling Stone asked me to do a, I guess you call it an obituary. I call it an appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be out, I don't know when, I guess fairly soon. And later on, I maybe in a month or two, I might do a column in The Voice, which would be entirely a personal column, not a, you know, his achievement or anything like that, just what I knew about him and why I liked him.
Okay, well, I look forward to reading that. Ned Hantoff, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and memories with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
It was very nice speaking with you. Bye-bye. Ned Hantoff spoke to us from his office in Manhattan, and he has written extensively about jazz in publications and in his many books. He's now a columnist with The Village Voice. We're going to hear now one of the sessions that he referred to. This is a session that he produced in the early 1960s with the Charles Mingus Jazz Workshop for Candid Records. And what we're going to hear is a piece that's a little longer than what we usually hear on Fresh Air. It's called What Love. It's one of Mingus's pieces. And it features an extended Charles Mingus bass solo, a longer solo than you usually get to hear on most of Mingus's records. And following the solo, there's some really interesting duet work between Eric Dolphy and Charles Mingus. And as Nat Hentoff explained, Dolphy was about to leave the band during this time, and as he explained, you hear some of the tension of that leaving communicating itself through this duet passage. So from this Charles Mingus Jazz Workshop album, we'll hear What Love, and it features Eric Dolphy, Ted Kersen, Danny Richmond, and Charles Mingus.
Thank you again for not applauding. You dig it? Now, we'll go on with What Love. One, two, three.